Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to FedSoc Forums. Today's discussion is titled Foreign Influence Operations and National Security. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Our moderator today is Vince Vitkowski. Vince is a long-term former chair of the Federal Society's International and National Security Law and Policy Practice Group. He is also a fellow at the National Security Institute at the Scalia Law School of George Mason University. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later. With that note, I will turn things over to our moderator to start today's discussion. Vince, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Libby. Hello. Thank you for sharing part of your day with us. Foreign influence operations have become an increasingly important part of the national security matrix. Their objectives are not necessarily only or primarily to achieve specific policy objectives. Often they're meant to create the appearance of policy disagreements, to undermine our confidence in our own judgments, and to drive a wedge between us and our key allies. To tell us more about this, we have two excellent panelists. Margaret Harker has served in all three branches of government. She led the investigation for the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, various investigations, including one on Chinese influence operations. She served in the DOJ's National Security Division, and she clerked for federal and state court judges. Also, she studied in Beijing and worked at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce China Center. Park McDougall is a writer and editor at Tablet Magazine. His work has covered a wide range of topics relating to foreign influence operations, including Chinese and Cuban backing for far-left radical groups. More recently, his work has focused on the so-called woke or anti-Semitic right, with particular emphasis on its ties to Russia. After initial presentations and follow-up dialogues, there will be an attempt to address the Q&A from the audience, from listeners through the vehicle that we have. So with that, I'll turn it over to Margaret.
Thank you, Vince, and thank you, Federalist Society, for having me on. The views I express today are my own, not those of my employer. Chinese Communist Party influence operations have been used with the intent to infiltrate and shape all facets of our society. This includes everything from our education system to Silicon Valley, Wall Street, our CEOs, our political leaders, associations, think tanks, religious communities, manufacturing of the goods that we use, supply chains, media, our food supply, healthcare, frankly, everything that Americans consume. These operations have been so successful that they've effectively shifted the incentives within our country for individuals and businesses to make decisions and choices that benefit the Chinese to the detriment of our own country. This afternoon, I'll give a brief overview of the goal of these operations, the key tactics used, the state of play for federal agencies, both how they've responded and how they themselves have been influenced or captured in certain instances. I'll close with a discussion of telltale signs of influence operations and where things stand. These operations are best understood as part of a broader umbrella concept of political warfare, which is the employment of all means at a nation's command, short of war, to achieve its national objectives. It's also been described by the People's Liberation Army in China as unrestricted or disintegration warfare, the use of non-kinetic means to destroy enemies within. As I give my overview, I ask you to keep in mind a few thoughts and questions. What is the outlook for our country? I believe this is fundamentally a cultural problem. We need clear answers to three questions. What are we fighting for, not just against? Are we being honest about what we're facing? Do we have the agency to act? Agency in the face of AI? Agency in the face of bureaucracies? The goal of these operations is to weaken and defeat the enemy so that the enemy can't win in the event of a kinetic war. The CCP has identified America as its primary enemy. And in effect, it has been waging a Cold War for decades against our country. But unlike the first Cold War, the adversary is already within. The CCP has entrenched itself within our borders and our institutions. I'll turn now to some of the key tactics. First, divide and conquer. Influence operations are designed to fuel division, to actively sow discord within our country. This could include anything from exploiting social and political divisions, fears about so-called climate change, even serious concerns that Americans have about our country's involvement in so-called endless wars. Proxies, the use of proxies, are a key component that the Chinese use. They get others who serve as proxies to do their bidding for them. This could be done in any number of settings: academic, policy, lobbying on behalf of U.S. companies. It's notable when you think about it that there's not more money in lobbying in D.C. that comes directly from China, despite the outsized influence of Chinese interests within Washington. This demonstrates the prevalence of CCP proxies. Proxies can be obtained through elite capture. The CCP captures elites through basic tactics: flattery, enticement, with titles, honors, money, business deals, even plain old social pressure. All aspects of society are targeted. No level is too high or too low. Elite capture can be done in a direct manner or an indirect manner. Examples of direct could be financing and cooperation of elite universities such as Harvard University, or cooperation with think tanks in Washington, D.C., even the ones you probably like. Unrestricted warfare has many components. I'll highlight just a few of them. Political warfare, again, that's the umbrella term that I mentioned earlier. Also, psychological, economic, AI, cyber, energy, drug, and information warfare, among others. You might ask whether our leaders have been asleep at the wheel. The short answer is yes. But over 25 years ago, a House Select Committee on China, led by Congressman Chris Cox, issued a report finding that the PRC used espionage, commercial entities, and vast networks to engage with scientists, business people, and academics as part of their warfare operations against America. Sound familiar? Despite this warning, American political and economic leaders continued to sell our nation's soul to the CCP. 25 years later, in October 2024, the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, under Chairman James Comer, conducted the first and only government-wide investigation into CCP political warfare and the response of the government. It investigated 25 federal agencies and found that there was no government-wide strategy under the Biden administration. This culminated in a 300-page report. I led the investigation at the staff level, and we'll share relevant highlights today. The committee issued a scorecard to each of the 25 agencies. I'll highlight some of the shocking failures, all of which, keep in mind, reflect cross-cutting issues relevant today to the federal government, state governments, and other institutions still affected by these operations. The USDA under Biden was reluctant to criticize China at all to the committee, emphasizing that China is its top customer, an example, again, of how the incentives have been shifted. They had no plan to secure the food supply, despite serious CCP influence in the agricultural industry in our country. The State Department under Biden couldn't determine the number and nature of the many memoranda of understandings, MOUs, it has entered into with China. Suggested there are close to 1 million MOUs, demonstrating significant entanglement between the deep state and the CCP. The DOJ under Biden succumbed to a Chinese influence operation itself by terminating the sole program focused on enforcing federal national security law against the CCP. This was known as the China Initiative. They did so based on uncorroborated claims of racial bias, claims that the department under Biden acknowledged itself were baseless. This falling for an influence operation highlights a particularly effective tactic that the CCP uses, that is exploiting vulnerabilities such as Americans' views on race. Three strategic failures that crossed a number of agencies are especially worth mentioning. Many agencies have mistakenly employed country-agnostic programs. These are programs that do not in any way specifically target CCP entities or unique tactics or patterns threatening national security. Given the lack of focus, agencies, especially in law enforcement and intelligence, are ill-equipped to counter CCP warfare. Second, many agencies under Biden employed misguided foreign malign influence task forces and initiatives to get at the problem. An example is DOJ under Biden embraced this endeavor, lumping the CCP in with other foreign adversaries, who are of course a concern, but this compromised law enforcement. And despite President Trump's work to root out initiatives of this kind, rhetoric continues in the intelligence community and national security community today. The problem with targeting so-called foreign malign influence is the term lumps legal and illegal activity together, enabling overreach and abuse of power. While it's difficult for law enforcement to address Chinese influence operations that poses threats but doesn't always violate the law, that challenge doesn't justify law enforcement acting in an unauthorized way. Progress has been made to correct strategic failure in employing foreign malign influence programs. President Trump eliminated the Global Engagement Center, the Foreign Influence Task Force, and curbed powers of the Foreign Malign Influence Center at ODNI. Also, there have been important lawsuits challenging the censorship and violation of the First Amendment, all done in the name of combating foreign influence. Examples include Missouri v. Biden, Daily Wire versus State, and Dressen versus Flaherty. A third example of a strategic failure in the Biden administration is that there was no serious concern about agencies needing to resist CCP influence or psychological warfare, as it's known, within the government. It's striking that no agency took seriously the question of influence affecting their decision-making. This highlights that decades of CCP influence, especially in elite educational institutions, have resulted in subtle influence, the targets of which may not be aware. The key reason these operations are so effective is that they're often subtle and wouldn't work otherwise. Finally, I'll turn to the current state of play. The Trump administration has stopped the bleeding in many ways, and states around the country have been active in taking it seriously. But despite important shifts in government, there is significant evidence of ongoing influence operations. Telltale signs people have been influenced include resignation that America has declined and nothing can be done about it, defeatist mentalities, rhetoric that China is the future, it's rising, we're the past, sudden unexplained shifts in views following a uniform script to communicate those views. Given the success of these decades-long operations priming society for division, the CCP has positioned itself to turn a switch, unleash an algorithm, and change the thoughts of many Americans. Think about it. If you have masses of people suddenly waking up with strong opinions about topics they never knew anything about or they never cared much about, and they're going to the streets or they're going to social media to espouse those views, often using the same script, there's a good chance they've fallen for an influence operation. An example of how this plays out is TikTok, which is controlled by the CCP, serving as the digital director, the source, the script for the latest agenda. This is coupled with, for example, as Park will get into more detail on, the Roy Singham Network and Jody Evans' Code Pink-backed protests, which served to provide the visible, almost brick-and-mortar structure for the operation. Singham, a CCP-connected wealthy American man who resides in China, and Evans, his wife, it's been reported, that together they've funded and facilitated protests on U.S. soil. These protests have promoted anti-Semitism on college campuses. In some cases, perhaps it's been alleged resulted in violence. They've been behind anti-ICE protests and so-called No Kings protests. There is legal recourse under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, which is a broad statute requiring transparency and disclosures for people acting as agents of foreign principals when seeking to influence the public. This could be used in the Stingham Network, at least for those who are based in the U.S., to obtain registration, disclosure, and additional transparency about the source of this, these protests. FARA could also be used to more effectively, could be better enforced if DOJ prioritized national security instead of political concerns by focusing on entities like TikTok, Amazon, and Apple that Americans regularly engage with and are actively influenced by, all of which have Chinese ties. It could also be enforced against think tanks seeking to shape policy. I'll reiterate, it's essential that FARA and national security investigations are not done in the name of foreign malign influence, misinformation, disinformation, or malinformation, because the use of these Orwellian terms invites abuse of power and unlawful censorship. I'll close by sharing that I've had the opportunity to witness these operations from a number of vantage points. As a longtime China watcher, very concerned about these operations affecting our country, I studied in Beijing 04 to 05 before the CCP's coming out in the 08 Olympics. I worked at the U.S. Chamber promoting U.S. business in China during the heyday of American corporate ambitions, the time of win-win cooperation following China joining the WTO in 2001. Having also worked in politics, I witnessed lobbyists, academics, and politicians advancing Chinese interests, all while thinking or pretending they were advancing American interests. I've investigated national security matters involving China, the National Security Division at DOJ, focusing on FARA. And what I've witnessed leads me to believe that the CCP's continued success in these operations depends entirely on the strength of our own nation, our culture, our communities. Much can be done if we know what we are preserving and building for our country, in addition to what we are rejecting in Red China. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Bork?
Yeah, thank you, Margaret. So just as a preface, I'm neither a lawyer nor a veteran of government. So some of the kind of finer points of policy are probably best directed to Margaret. And then another note is just foreign influence is such a vast topic, and there are so many elements of it, so many different actors, so many ways we can talk about it, that there are a lot of things that we're not going to be able to address here, and that I'm sure some people in the audience may have more expertise in specific areas than we do. With that said, I basically want to start with some kind of high level framing remarks. And I may actually disagree with Margaret, at least in one respect, which is to me, and this is something that has come out more as I have been looking into the world of kind of social media influence operations. And Vince, you and I were talking before the panel started about this, you know, sudden emergence of young people who have very seemingly extreme views, either about Jews in Israel or about the United States and its role in the world, who see America as kind of a malign force. Where are they getting this stuff? Largely, they are not reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. They're picking up this news from platforms like TikTok, like X, from listening to podcasts, from watching clips of podcasters and clips of streamers. And so my work recently has been focused on how kind of influence operations are moving through this ecosystem. So at the most basic level, I think part of the problem is understanding the adversary here. And there are a lot of, I know people who are involved in the pro-Israel space. There's, Qatari, Turkish influence efforts on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood. often targeting Israel. But the big one that we usually talk about is China. And I think Margaret said, and in the House report, you know, we're in a new Cold War and the new adversary is China. And unlike in the first Cold War, China is already inside the gates. There's a researcher named Trevor Loudon who runs a thing called KeyWiki, which is kind of an online resource for foreign influence efforts. And he has a phrase that I like that, you know, the Cold War never ended. The idea that the Cold War ended is a Western and kind of American misconception. It didn't end for the Chinese and it didn't end for the Russians. And, you know, I think we often talk about China as the primary adversary. And in some ways, it's easy for Republicans to talk about China because talking about Russia has all these sort of connotations of 2016 and the kind of abuses of the intelligence process that the Democrats perpetrated against the Trump administration and tried to delegitimize his presidency. But I think really the adversary is this axis of hostile authoritarian states. So China, but also Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, and until recently Venezuela, sort of see how that one works out. Some people have called this the axis of authoritarians, but it basically resembles the communist bloc of the Cold War, albeit, you know, with some changes. Most of Eastern Europe is now in our camp. Russia is nominally kind of a conservative or right-wing power, even though in practice it is run by a security establishment of KGB veterans. Now, these states coordinate with one another. They mutually support one another. They cooperate on sanctions evasion. They share intelligence and military technology. There's a report just today in the Financial Times that China was sharing satellite info with Iran. Basically commercial satellites, allowing Iran to purchase them to target U.S. bases in the Middle East. And we've also seen, you know, a half dozen reports at this point that the Russians are directly sharing military satellite intelligence with the Iranians to help them with targeting. Cuban and North Korean troops are fighting in Ukraine, in Africa and Latin America. Chinese, you know, business and commercial interests often kind of follow in the wake of Russian mercenaries and military presence. And the same is true when it comes to foreign influence. So China, Russia, and Iran all amplify one another's propaganda. The Chinese assets in the United States promote the Russian line in Ukraine and Europe. And Russian assets back Chinese claims in Taiwan and Xinjiang. And both of them amplify Iranian propaganda about the Middle East and Israel and the U.S. role in the Middle East. And I want to emphasize this point that these are all at some level the same thing, because in some respects, the Russians are a lot more active than the Chinese, especially in this information space and especially on the American right. And the way I've come to think of it is that they're kind of operating on the basis of an internal division of labor. So the Chinese really focus a lot on the left and kind of far left radical groups. And I'm going to get to Singham's network in a bit. And they, you know, have really integrated themselves into these kind of communist radical socialist spaces in New York City and in other places in the United States, whereas the Russians do a lot more work on the right. So, you know, it's kind of, I'm sure we're all familiar with this sudden emergence, seemingly out of nowhere, of kind of nominally right-wing influencers promoting kind of protocols of the Elders of Zion tier conspiracy theories about Jewish control of the United States. I don't want to say all of that comes from Russia, but I think the Russians are very active in promoting that. And they're basically pushing in the same direction beneath the surface level ideological differences. And a very clear example of this is how they'll talk about Israel. So the Chinese will pump out propaganda about how, you know, the Zionist imperialists control American foreign policy. And it's very much couched in kind of communist, socialist, anti-imperialist language. And, you know, the Russians will talk more openly about the Jews or the neocons or these groups that have become kind of, you know, bad words on sections of the American right. But really, they're, it's the same stuff with different branding, and it's pointing towards the same thing, which is, you know, American assertion of its interest in the Middle East is illegitimate because it is, you know, controlled by the Jews or the Zionists, controlled by Israel on behalf of Israel, not on behalf of the United States. And, you know, the United States should get out, wash its hands of it. And a lot of this operates through this idea of, it's a Soviet concept called reflexive control. But the idea is feeding people information to lead them to a predetermined conclusion while making them feel like they came to that conclusion on their own. So basically pumping out this idea that the establishment is radically corrupt and evil and must be overthrown. And then whether they break to the far left or the far right, you have sort of ready-made foreign policy conclusions being presented to them by trusted influencers who you have also played a role in kind of boosting. And, you know, these ideas would be things like, you know, China and Russia and Iran aren't our real enemies. The real enemy is the establishment, or the real enemy is the other party, or, you know, our own intelligence agencies. Ukraine or Taiwan or the Middle East aren't our business. The real enemy is inside America. The real enemy is the Zionists or the Jews or NATO or the EU. And, you know, just anything that's kind of producing this chaos and trying to produce this acceptance of, you know, as Margaret said, the United States' role in the world is done. Let's just come back here, leave the rest of the world to our adversaries. So probably the easiest example to talk about here is, as Margaret said, the Singham Network. It's an easy one. It's very obvious. Singham is, estimates of his net worth vary, but probably a little under $1 billion. Wealthy American-born businessman, made a bunch of money in software. Old-time communist from the 70s. He was a self-described Maoist, used to be kind of a radical labor organizer and was involved in kind of vaguely Soviet or Chinese connected labor organizing in the United States. At some point, he moves to Shanghai. You know, he's working with Huawei. He's married to Jody Evans, who runs a group called Code Pink. And he basically operates this global propaganda network on behalf of China. And I'll quote from a recent Fox News investigation, just to give you kind of a sense of the scale of this thing. Fox News Digital has identified at least 200 organizations in Singham's network of about 2,000 organizations that directly work on propaganda that parrots the anti-American messaging of the Chinese Communist Party, but is dramatically homegrown in digital shops from New York City to Los Angeles. So that's basically narrative laundering is what that is. It's the Russians do it and the Chinese do it. And you're taking foreign narratives that originate in Beijing or Moscow or Tehran and putting them in native dress and trying to make them appear like organic American political thought to Americans. Moving on. Using large language models, Fox News Digital analyzed 223 transactions that moved $591 million in total across five continents from 2017 through 2025, the latest year for which figures are available. 11 U.S. nonprofit organizations form a core hub of the work that prompts pro-China, anti-American propaganda in the world, with a total of about $401 million flowing from Singham and his network into these organizations. Now, my guess is that's not $500 million of Singham's own money. He's probably acting as a front for Chinese government money or other wealthy Chinese, but that's sort of neither here nor there. These groups are groups like Code Pink, the People's Forum, which played a major role in sort of organizing and serving as an organizing hub for the campus protests in New York City under Biden. So if you remember the Columbia University encampment in, I believe, April 2024 that the NYPD had to go break up, those organizers went to the People's Forum to gather before and strategize before moving up to Columbia's campus. They have a media arm called Breakthrough News that has been sort of trying to insert itself in the alternative you know, YouTube media space. And then they have various front groups like Code Pink, the Answer Coalition, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And these are basically just old kind of communist tactics of creating a bunch of front groups. So you can say, you know, we had 80 organizations sign a statement for peace or hands off Taiwan, make it look like it has more support than it has. And how am I doing on time, Vince?
Tell you in a second. You're kind of in overtime, but keep going.
Okay. All right. I'll do the shorter version of it, but, a point to make about the Singham stuff is that even as it is pushing all this pro CCP stuff, it is also pushing the pro Russian line into left wing spaces. So Code Pink, the Singham group, has been regularly organizing, you know, since the Russian full-scale invasion in 2022, you know, peace protests in congressional offices, demanding an end to funding of weapons for Ukraine, claiming that backing Ukraine will inevitably escalate to a nuclear war between the United States and Russia, backing kind of Russian narratives about how the cause of the war was NATO expansion. And when I was actually looking into this, I just want to illustrate this because it's a great example of reflexive control about how the point of this is to make people draw these conclusions themselves. Someone was posting in a subreddit about the city of Cleveland, a Code Pink poster they had found about Ukraine. And they were asking, what is this poster? It looks like Russian propaganda to me. And another user says, look, this is Code Pink. They're tied to the Singham Network. It's funded by the Chinese Communist Party. They're essentially a Chinese Communist Party propaganda organization. And, you know, they make excuses for the genocide in Xinjiang and all these other things. And a person responds to that and says, you know, it's really hard to get exercised about Chinese influence when the whole government is run by Israel. Why don't we talk about that? And the person who had posted the explanation that Code Pink was a CCP front group said, you know, I think you're right. It is a scandal that the government is run by AIPAC, but we should be consistent here and call it out wherever we see it. So there you have people drawing on their own the conclusion that, you know, hey, communist China, Israel, basically, you know, same level of problem for the United States. And then finally, and I'll wrap it. I have some more, but we can get to it later. Just an example of how this can work with the Russians on the right. Some of you may be familiar with an outlet named called Gray Zone and a journalist named Max Blumenthal. They have long been sort of a tanky outlet, Stalinist outlet in their politics. They basically cover China, Russia, the Middle East, and Latin America, and, you know, basically back the perspective of the hostile state in each of those areas and push out, you know, so when they cover Ukraine, they will push out narratives from Russian intelligence about, you know, Ukrainian biolabs. They do Uyghur genocide denial. They do crazy anti-Semitic stuff on behalf of Iran in the Middle East. There was a document leak where one of their editors was revealed to be taking under the table payments from Press TV, which is the Iranian state media organization. And they're all sort of regulars on, you know, Russia Today and Sputnik and these Russian state media organizations. So it's just it is a laundromat for Russian, Chinese, Iranian propaganda is what it is. But for a long time, nominally leftist. In 2023, two of the founders had a falling out with one another and started yelling at each other on Twitter. So it's Blumenthal and this guy, Ben Norton, who subsequently moved to Beijing. But Ben Norton is saying, look, I don't trust Max Blumenthal anymore. He's become a fascist because him and his wife have become very close to Tucker Carlson. And later, when there's a scandal with the Biden administration involving a sort of NSA intercept of Tucker Carlson talking to what's described in the media as a Kremlin cutout, Max Blumenthal's wife writes an article for the Gray Zone saying, I'm who they're saying the cutout is, and I have provided an introduction between Tucker and Vladimir Putin's inner circle to, you know, try to facilitate an interview or a meeting, which later ultimately came off. And the other thing that happens around that time is they start doing extremely laudatory coverage of Joe Kent, who weirdly, for a nominally left-wing publication, is a kind of pretty hard right congressional candidate in Washington state. But they're praising Joe Kent as the peace candidate and, you know, flowery profile of him. And this is one of Norton's complaints when he feuds with Blumenthal and leaves. Later, during the recent, when Joe Kent resigned from his position as the head of the National Counterterrorism Center, citing what he claimed was kind of undue Israeli interference on Donald Trump in the planning of Operation Epic Fury, one of the first people to come to the subsequent amplification of this story operated through this sort of parallel network of Blumenthal taking it to the lefties and Carlson taking it to the righties. And you could see that these personal connections had sort of been established 2 or 3 years back. So I have a few other notes here, but I feel like I've been going on too long and we should probably address that later on.
That's good. Margaret, do you have any comments, observations, reactions, thoughts about the subject?
Yes, thank you, Vince. One thing I will disagree with or that I want to mention is I don't think it's actually easy for Republicans or Democrats to talk about China. I think they all give lip service to China now that President Trump has put this issue on the map, but actually following up with legislation or action that would make a difference in communities or industries infiltrated by China, I think it's a whole different ballgame. There's a lot to be done and very little that frankly has been done. Secondly, I would say I in no way intended to say that propaganda is a uniquely Chinese matter or that the Chinese and the Russians don't push each other's propaganda for each other. I simply am saying that, one, the goal is to divide whoever's executing the influence operation. And an important distinction between China and Russia, I almost feel like we're the subject of an influence operation arguing about which one's more effective, but because it's dividing us, right? Is that the Chinese are fully integrated in every industry in this country, including our tech companies, including business. And given those relationships and that infiltration, there are great incentives for self-censorship and engagement to go along with lines that the Chinese government wants. And again, these are subtle. That's why it works. So those are really the things I want to emphasize in response to Park at the outset.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. And I realize I lost my place in my notes and flubbed my the anecdote about Kent and Blumenthal a bit. The point I wanted to make was that Blumenthal, after establishing these connections with Carlson, subsequently becomes the initial and main source for the story in the immediate wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination, that Charlie Kirk was under tremendous pressure from Zionist donors over his criticism of Israel. And this is the story that is subsequently picked up by Candace Owens and turned into the claim that Israel killed Charlie Kirk. And then there's, you know, very strong documentation that these claims are then, you know, boosted by, I've seen Russian, I imagine also Chinese, sort of bot networks, LLMs, other forms of kind of artificial platform manipulation to get out this claim that Israel killed Charlie Kirk. So that was, you know, not just them talking to each other or whatever. You can see this kind of transmission mechanism for how ludicrous claims like this become embedded into right-wing social media discourse. That said, I totally agree with Margaret that the Chinese are much more deeply embedded in our kind of like everyday lives, in the US economy, clearly. I mean, bilateral trade with Russia is virtually non-existent. Whereas we have, you know, massive national champion tech giants that are still deeply, deeply involved with China.
Margaret, did you have other observations?
I guess, you know, going back to FARA, which is sort of the one statute that I found at DOJ, folks like to try to jam influence operations into, and it doesn't always work because it is a very broad statute. It's hard to prove the good cases. I think Park mentioned communist countries sort of layering organization upon organization, making these vast networks that are hard to identify. I found that to be the case with the Chinese and some entities that ought to be registered under FARA. They're being very difficult to prove given these networks and sort of a lack of ownership of who is actually the agent conducting the activity. But an important thing from a law enforcement standpoint to point out about using FARA is that we do have free speech in this country, and you can agree with some crazy Chinese or crazy Russian person, right? And just because you have that viewpoint doesn't mean you're getting it from, you know, some foreign principle that you need to be disclosing it to the Department of Justice under. And so I think it's tricky, though there are good cases that can be brought, and the ones I mentioned earlier, TikTok, Amazon, and Apple, I think would be fruitful. I also think some think tanks would be fruitful. And the reason I say that is because while for the past number of years, DOJ had focused on FARA in a politicized way, that was upsetting, I think, to many Americans, disappointing because what sort of national security interests were being served there. Pursuing FARA in this other realm of entities that actually Americans interact with all the time, TikTok, your Apple phone, your Amazon account, right? Might make a difference. It might be interesting to learn, oh, this, you know, this vehicle that's sort of my perception of reality is actually tied to an adversary that's trying to control me in some way. That might make a difference. And I go back to this being a cultural problem, right? I mean, you can pass legislation and whatnot, but fundamentally, if we don't have the wherewithal to think for ourselves and discern for ourselves, you know, we have no hope. But we do have hope because there's always hope. And I do think there are good tools. FARA is one of them. It just needs to be enforced with national security interests in mind, and not political maneuvering of, you know, the latest lobbyist on K Street that you don't like, who got money, oh, shocking, from Qatar or wherever. I mean, not saying that's not a problem, but I think most Americans are not surprised to learn that, but they might be surprised to know about the network that Park described, you know, that Roy Singham has set up, that, you know, many of their friends in college are going to protest at these events. And where do these ideas come from? I mean, maybe you would be embarrassed or ashamed to learn that this is where your ideas were coming from. Just a thought there.
Yeah. And I mean, I want to echo that too, because like a lot of this stuff, I'm sure there are crimes somewhere being committed, you know, or cases that could be brought. But it's also not always a law enforcement matter. You know, sometimes it's a matter of, you know, pointing out where these narratives are coming from. And, you know, I think I also have plenty of criticisms of how the sort of counter disinformation complex evolved and was abused under the Biden administration. But I think the good version of that can be when you have these institutions, whether they're public or private, that are doing things like publicly identify coordinated and inauthentic activity on social media platforms, where they're noting that, okay, here's a Chinese botnet or a Russian botnet or evidence of a, you know, a large language model or something like that, manipulating search results or Wikipedia entries, or trying to amplify the voice of a certain influencer or a certain narrative, you know, in ways that are meant to damage the United States or U.S. national security. And that wouldn't, you know, I think some people would say, you know, whatever, it's a deep state trying to control my thoughts. But I do think some people would say, like, oh, that's, I didn't know this, you know, this is coming, you know, basically straight from Beijing or straight from Moscow. That's interesting.
Or not to suggest a connection, intentional design, or anything intentional, but you'll often see Singham connected in some way with Goldman Sachs. Could you explain that?
My understanding, and Margaret, feel to jump in if you know a little more, is basically that he was just using, I don't want to say just, but, you know, I actually don't know what the kind of legal obligations on banks are for this type of stuff. But Goldman Sachs was providing him with a donor advised fund with which to sort of channel this money into American NGOs. And that's basically a service that financial institutions provide to, you know, to high net worth donors that allow them to mask the origins of their donations. So a lot of times, if you're looking at IRS 990s for, you know, say there's some radical protest, you see a bunch of NGOs are involved, you go to ProPublica to pull their tax filings, and it just says, you know, the donations come from Fidelity Charitable Trusts or Goldman Sachs or whatever. That's not Fidelity or Goldman giving that money. That is a donor donating through Fidelity or Goldman DAS to basically anonymize the donation.
Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that you did not get a chance to? And I know there were 100 things, but pick one or two. We have some questions.
Vince, one thing, there were many recommendations that the Oversight Committee made to federal agencies to better address CCP political warfare. And I won't bore you with all of them, but one that I think is worth noting, because it was striking how for most of my lifetime, our leaders have not done this at all. And that is to have leaders leading and speaking honestly about China to the American people, whether that's, you know, some official at some agency or a political leader. And I cannot emphasize enough the value of speaking honestly about these things so that people will be informed and be able to make choices in their own communities. And I will say that from my perspective, President Trump is the person who has changed the dialogue on China. In his first administration, and again now, he's been talking for decades about U.S. manufacturing and the bad deal we've gotten from China. After years of complicit engagement with the Chinese Communist Party on both sides, and lots of people getting rich while the rest of us kind of suffer with the cheap goods and the fentanyl addictions and all of the problems that have come with selling our soul to China. And so I'm glad to see better communication about this issue, whether it's from the president, from the head of NASA, from state leaders in Florida and Texas and Arkansas, where there's actually a lot of good action happening on the ground right now. That is something that has changed, and I hope will continue to improve, because I don't think people are, they might say China bad, but I don't think they're very honest about what the Chinese are really doing and how many Americans are now invested in maintaining that status quo, which exists today. The status quo hasn't changed all that much in terms of industry and cultural entanglement with China in our country.
I'm going to turn now to audience questions, and it is a very granular one. Not exact numbers, but are there any sources in which people could track how much money in the last, say, 10 years China has spent supporting the narrative that we have to get rid of fossil fuels? Is there someone who would do that?
I don't know specific on that issue. I do know, and I would refer you to the Oversight Committee's report from its investigation, that specifically the green energy agenda was something that the Chinese exploited big time for financial reasons and to sort of distract U.S. leaders, whether they're political leaders or business leaders, to think, oh, we're going to, you know, engage with you in this dialogue about greenhouse gases. Meanwhile, we're not going to follow, of course, any of these commitments that we're making, and you're going to lose all this money because this is a big loser financially for our country. And we're going to steal all your technology and solar panels and whatnot, and make it cheaper over here and compete with you economically. So I would consider that a form of economic warfare under the rubric of unrestricted warfare. But I don't know the specific numbers on that or source. But for more information, I would refer you to the Oversight Committee's report.
Okay.
I would say on that note, I mean, generally the way successful propaganda operates is not to invent something out of whole cloth. It is to try and piggyback on sort of pre-existing trends and issues, that emerge organically out of a society, whether that is a, you know, green movement on the left or, you know, anti-elite sentiment or mistrust of the establishment on either side of the aisle. So just because a foreign state is exploiting an issue doesn't mean the issue is totally sort of like fake or made up. And in fact, the ones that are often the best to exploit are the ones that have some sort of organic basis.
I'm going to basically read a question because it has a couple of interesting turns of phrase and also some assumptions embedded. So is Singham also involved in the divisive wave of iconoclasm which swept through the country for several years involving BLM, Antifa, and other anti-colonialist and imperialist groups? Basically, do we know when his involvement began, and did it include this?
From the investigative work I did on Capitol Hill, I did not uncover that specifically, but setting Singham aside for a moment, that is exactly the type of social and political issue that the Chinese would exploit. And, you know, whether that's through rhetoric on TikTok and social media or financial funding, it doesn't really matter. Both are very effective, and that's exactly the type of issue. Race in particular is one that the CCP is known for exploiting because Americans have strong views about it. And it's any opportunity that exists to sow further division, they want to take advantage of.
Yeah, and I just to piggyback off that a little bit, I mean, Singham is not the only kind of Chinese influence agent in the United States. I mean, there are other organizations. The China Freedom Road Socialist Organization is one that comes to mind. And I believe they were pretty involved in some of the BLM stuff. He's just one that's very prominent and that we know a lot about. He's so high profile, and there's so much sort of money and resources in his network that it's attracted a lot of attention. But that doesn't mean it's the only one active. And the other thing, and this is something I sort of caught earlier because I was taking too much time, but if you look at someone like Singham, and I think this is common, you know, the Chinese are not, generally speaking, inventing these groups out of whole cloth. There are a lot of these old left-wing communist far-left networks that go back to the Cold War and had connections to either the Soviets or the Cubans or other communist countries during the Cold War. And then, you know, obviously in the early 90s, the Russians kind of Soviet Union falls apart. There's no more funding from Moscow necessarily, but the people remain, you know, the contacts remain. And then, you know, a couple of decades later, when the Chinese are looking around for vehicles for their influence, they can kind of pick these organizations back up and, you know, make them flush with cash all of a sudden.
Yeah, very broad question. How would we define the right these days? Should there be another category? You know, the ultra right when people are doing polls.
Yeah. I mean, it's a deep question of political theory that I don't feel qualified to answer here, but we're in a two-party system, which kind of makes things easy. You know, most of the political spectrum falls in one way into the coalitions represented by one of the two major parties, and one is a party of the right and one is a party of the left. So that's basically a useful shorthand. And then, you know, adversaries will try to subvert elements of the party infrastructure and kind of bend their personnel or capture their elites or drive policy outcomes in some way. I sort of agree with the spirit of the question that there's certainly a lot, probably on both sides of the aisle, a lot of ideological weirdness going on that wouldn't map onto what one would normally think of as a Republican or a Democrat.
I think we have time for one more. I'm trying to find an interesting one. Can you comment on the CCP efforts to infiltrate and repress the Falun Gong epic times here in the U.S. and what U.S. the government could be doing to expose and discipline?
The CCP has a long history of suppressing minorities, minority groups, minority religious groups in their country, in Xinjiang and the Tibetans. And, there has been some outreach into the United States itself to oppress Falun Gong members here in the United States, which I know the Epic Times has covered much more thoroughly than I ever could. I have to admit, actually, I'm more of a law enforcement person than a policy person. So I don't know what specifically can or should be done. But I do think, back to my point earlier, the importance of speaking honestly about what the CCP is doing to sort of counter this. China's on the rise. China's the future. They're so much more together than we are because they have a totalitarian leader who can quickly pivot and make decisions. And we're stuck in a democratic republic with disagreements, right? You can counter that by pointing out, look at how they treat their people. The Chinese people are the greatest victims of the Chinese Communist Party. And so whether it's the Falun Gong or others who are repressed in China and around the world, let's know our enemy, know who the Chinese are, and that way we can refute this nonsense rhetoric about China being the better option than America.
Well, there were 20 questions in the queue here, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but we the clock rules us all, so I'm going to turn it back to Libby.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much for joining us today, for sharing your expertise and insights into this really fascinating and this really fascinating topic. There's certainly no end to this conversation, I think. And to Vince, of course, for moderating this discussion. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.